Pearl Nippon, fashion director and chief executive officer of Albert Nippon Incorporated. She and her design team are currently working on the company's Fall 87 line. The Nippon Spring Collection will be in the stores in early March. I'm Christiane Vaillancourt.
Christiane Vaillancourt reports on the arts every Thursday at this time. Funds for her reports are made possible by the Hunt Manufacturing Company and the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts. It's 3 minutes after four. This is Fresh Air, and you're tuned to WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. We have just gotten word that NPR will be broadcasting and we will be carrying live hearings on Monday from the House Committee on Foreign Affairs. The hearings will feature testimony by Secretary of State George Shultz. He'll testify at 8:30 in the morning, and then Robert McFarlane will testify at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. And this will be on the secret web of funneling profits from U.S.-Iran arms sales to Swiss bank accounts earmarked for the Contra rebels. So our broadcast will begin at 8:30 and will probably run late into the afternoon. That's Monday here on WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. Coming up in just a moment on Fresh Air, we'll be joined by Gloria Steinem, the founding editor of Ms. Magazine and one of the most quoted feminists in America. To many women, the most unfeminist symbol of womanhood is Marilyn Monroe, voluptuous, vulnerable, in a constant state of sexual arousal, but not very smart. That's her image. Gloria Steinem, who once walked out on a Marilyn Monroe movie because she was so offended, now is very moved by Monroe's life and work. She looks at Monroe from a feminist perspective in her new book, Marilyn, Norma Jean. Before we meet Gloria Steinem, this is Marilyn Monroe.
If I know just what to say when some trouble heads his way and can make him feel that everything is good, that I act like a woman and he likes a woman to act like a woman should. If he's late and I'm alone and he doesn't telephone and the kiss that greets him says I understood, then I act like a woman and he likes a woman to act like a woman should. And if I keep that love light shining in my eyes, though I'm hurt by something he may say, it doesn't take him very long to realize that it's more than just devotion that makes me act that way. And as years go passing by, if I still can't catch his eye and his love runs deeper than he thought it could, then I act like a woman and he's got a woman who acts like a woman, like a woman should.
Was Marilyn Monroe. Gloria Steinem puts Marilyn Monroe's life, death, and work in a feminist context in her new book, Marilyn, Norma Jean. Steinem first wrote about Monroe in a 1973 essay. Her new book features the photographs of George Barris, who was collaborating with Monroe on her autobiography before she died. Barris took most of the pictures in the book during the last summer of Monroe's life. The book, Marilyn, Norma Jean, is published by Henry Holt. Welcome back to Fresh Air, Gloria Steinem.
Thank you. And thank you for playing that record. You know, I had not had the opportunity to listen to her without seeing her. I went back and looked at her films again, but I didn't just listen. And she is a much better singer than I think she's been given credit for.
I actually really enjoy her singing. Mm-hmm. And lately I found myself in the past couple of years or so going back to her movies and also buying her records. And like a lot of other women, I really didn't like Marilyn Monroe when I was young. And she seemed like a caricature of a woman. I don't know. I guess this is part of a phenomenon. What changed you? What made you interested in her?
Well, I had the same response you did, and I think lots of women did. Even while she was alive, she commented kind of sadly on the fact that her fame was an entirely masculine phenomenon, that women reacted badly to her, and that made her feel bad, in fact. But it was like watching an ethnic stereotype on screen, or in art, for women, like watching a female impersonator. You know, she was exaggerating everything that we were supposed to do. And being very vulnerable. And I mean, she did make me feel humiliated. But what changed me first, I suppose, was simply her death, because suddenly I realized that there was a lot of unhappiness inside that image that I had not been sensitive to or aware of. And then what changed me even more was beginning to understand where that image came from and being willing to admit that I was doing it too. You know,
that you were doing what too?
Well, being a female impersonator. If you know what I mean, that we were all trained to do this, you know, to giggle and laugh and pretend not to know what we really knew and, you know, and all the mannerisms that we know. So that was why I wrote a little short essay on her in 73, because I began to wonder if she might not have been helped in the way that so many millions of women have been by just a little support and a little understanding.
Well, you know, when I used to watch her when I was younger, I used to think this performance is not about me and it's not for me, it's for the men. And I felt like the men owned her.
Mm-hmm.
And that
that's a great way of putting it. Right. No, exactly. Exactly. Not only was it not for us and were we no part of it, but also it was being held up to us as an impossible standard of what we had to do if we wanted to be approved of by men.
Well, how would you compare Marilyn Monroe to the female stars of Hollywood of her period who women really did enjoy and feel a certain mm-hmm. empathy with?
Well, I think that they had some more sense of control over their own lives or power, or anyway, they didn't come on in quite that humiliated way. I mean, you know, Katharine Hepburn was somebody who appealed to women a lot, and she's certainly the antithesis of Marilyn Monroe. She's vulnerable, but she's also self-willed, and she's nobody's fool, and she's, you know, not being made fun of. And I think you can see that, you know, across the board. I mean, Audrey Hepburn, for instance, was also somebody who appealed greatly to women, I think, for the same reason.
You know, we're talking about that phenomenon of going back to Marilyn Monroe and seeing her in a different light. For me, one of the things that makes the difference is 30 years, you know, that it's been, or 20 years, however long it's been since the movie that I'm watching or the record that I'm listening to. And I no longer feel threatened by it because history separates us. And I don't mean just threatened by how sexy she is, but mm-hmm. threatened by that image of womanhood, which I feel somehow I might be measured against.
Mm-hmm.
I know I won't be because the movie or the record, it's historical. That's in the past.
That's true.
No, I could define it on different terms.
No, you're absolutely right. But I think even someone doing it in the present is likely to do it in a different way. I mean, how do you feel about Madonna, for instance?
Well, I guess I don't watch her that much, and I hear her records, and some of them I like, and some of them I don't. But I just don't feel a part of that world very much. So it doesn't. I see. I don't know. I hear her records in a fairly kind of objective way. You know, do I like the record or not? And mm-hmm. I don't feel her image doesn't speak to me one way or another.
Well, yeah, we're also part of it as our age. I mean, we're no longer the fan age,
exactly.
Perhaps, but I noticed that Madonna's audience is the opposite of Marilyn's. I mean, Marilyn's was mostly older men and or, you know, adult men, and Madonna's is teenage girls. And yet Madonna has taken all the accoutrements of Marilyn's looks and that kind of style and phenomenon, and this clearly, you know, almost a Monroe lookalike, but she takes all these things and makes them powerful. You know, she She's in control of them. She's nobody's victim.
She's totally aggressive.
Yeah. So young girls like that. You know, it's kind of a relief, I think, to see that you don't have to be a victim. You can take all these things that society has given you and say, you've given me this stuff? Okay, fine. I'm going to use it and I'm going to, you know, do what I want with it.
One of the things that has really interested me in looking at some of Monroe's movies, like Some Like It Hot, for instance, is how by today's standards she'd be considered heavy.
Mm-hmm.
And I think she was probably heavier in that movie than in some of the other movies. But it does really make you think about how arbitrary different periods' views of female beauty
mm-hmm.
is.
Yes,
know?
Absolutely. And I think that is something that's very rarely examined. That is the why of the standard of beauty at a particular moment. Though if you look at it historically, it's very clear that after a war, there is almost always a period of time in which women are supposed to be very voluptuous, very traditional, because you're supposed to go home and have babies to make up for the people who, you know, have killed each other in this war. And it was doubly true perhaps after World War II, because women were also supposed to get out of the defense plants and the jobs that they had had while the men were in the service. So Marilyn came along at that time and was both rewarded and encouraged to exaggerate, I think, that voluptuousness, a very bosomy, hippie kind of beauty. Whereas when society wants less population, then you get a more boyish figure as the ideal. You know, you get an Audrey Hepburn or even Twiggy in the 60s as an ideal.
Gloria Steinem is my guest. We're discussing Marilyn Monroe, which is the subject of her new book, Marilyn, Norma Jean. Let's talk about her appeal to men. You talk about how she represented sex without power.
Sex without challenge, I would say, especially, which is the same as saying without power, as far as men were concerned. And Norman Mailer is very honest about that in his book about Marilyn, that she represented this, you know, totally unchallenging, totally approving vision of a child woman who, you know, sex with offered no challenge. I think he said sex with her would be like ice cream or something. And this appeal of the child woman to a man who has been encouraged by society to believe that he has to be dominant in order to be a man, and therefore, you know, can't handle adult women that well, is very powerful, and certainly was even more powerful in the 50s.
You point out that, that you think big breasts make a woman seem more vulnerable. I'd really never thought of it in that way.
Well, I worry about, you know, when I see women in the street sometimes or I see women on the screen who are very big-breasted, I worry about them. I feel, because I think, you know, they're much more likely. It isn't a thought. It's just a visceral reaction, you know, that somehow they need protection more. But, of course, it isn't necessarily the physical part of it at all, because look at Dolly Parton. Dolly Parton can, you know, she's nobody's victim. I mean, she can take care of herself, thank you very much. And so when I see her, I'm not embarrassed by it. I think, you know, it depends on how powerful the individual woman is.
You might know, I'm not sure about this, if Marilyn Monroe has been a pinup for lesbian women, if she's a powerful symbol or, you know,
I don't
kind
think
of important
so.
Erotic.
I was interested in that, too. But logically enough, perhaps, she doesn't seem to be a pinup for lesbian women who are, I mean, I don't mean to be, you know, biased the other way here, but I mean, who are less into role playing, it seems to me. But she is a pinup for men. For transvestite men, I mean, there are you know, great numbers of men who dress up as Marilyn Monroe and play that role.
You walked out on one of her movies. I think it was Gentlemen Prefer Blondes.
Yes.
Why'd you walk out?
Because I felt humiliated. You know, I felt I imagine a black movie goer does watching a racial stereotype. You know, watching Step and Fetch It or something. It just made me feel bad about myself. And also, kind of, how dare she be as vulnerable as I feel, but I don't want to be that vulnerable.
You met her in the 1950s at the Actors Studio, was it?
Mm-hmm.
What was that experience like?
Well, that was remarkable for being the complete opposite, almost. Not the complete opposite, but quite different from her screen appearance, because she was there as an auditor. I was just there as an observer for a day. She was going fairly regularly as part of her studies of acting. And she was just so shy and so apologetic for taking up space there, you know, kind of trying to make herself small and with a kerchief over her head. And all these kind of smart-ass New York actors, at least that was the atmosphere, seemed to be taking some pleasure in pretending to ignore her while being entirely aware of her presence. You know, she was this kind of luminous presence in the background. But I remember her shyness and again, the feeling that you wanted to protect her somehow.
When did you start seeing her as a victim?
Well, her death had to wake us up to, you know, feminist, not feminist, whatever our politics were. I think it woke us up to the amount of unhappiness that there was inside, because even supposing that final incident was accidental or not her own doing, she had it revealed that she had tried to commit suicide many times before, and at least several times really apparently wanted to commit suicide, since she was very angry when she was rescued.
Your new book features a lot of photographs that George Barris did for the summer before her death. How did you find out about the photographs and get hooked up with him?
Well, it was not due to me, but my publisher, Henry Holt, who knew about the photographs who learned about them. And it happened because George Barris, the photographer, had taken these photographs in the last summer of her life to do an autobiographical book in collaboration with her. And that collaboration was cut off by her death. And George, who was a very kind man, was just wiped out by this. So he went to Paris to get away. And in Paris, he met a woman and fell in love and had two daughters and raised the daughters. And, you know, he just never did very much with most of the photographs or the notes that he had taken. So when he came back to this country to live again, Henry Holt bought the rights to these photographs and to the notes and called me up and asked if I would be interested in writing a book to accompany them, because they knew, you know, they had published my anthology, so they clearly knew about this other little brief essay. But also, no major book had been written by a woman. And Dick Seaver, the head of Holt, said, you know, it's time. And I thought, it's interesting, he's right. Though I wasn't, in some sense, I confess that I did it out of interest, but also out of fundraising impulse, because I somehow realized that you couldn't write a book about Marilyn Monroe and keep the money. You know, I mean, everybody's profiteered off her so much. I don't know, you just can't do that. So I thought it was a way of raising money, and, you know, better I should be writing to raise money than standing in living rooms, you know, tap dancing to raise money. So, I decided to do it, and I wasn't quite prepared for how hooked I got once I started. And also how glad I was that the money was going to something else, because I realized that Marilyn would have wanted it to go to children. So we earmarked a Marilyn Monroe Children's Fund, because she herself had such a terrible childhood and was so connected to kids and gave money to orphanages. And I thought, well, you know, maybe she would have liked this.
And she grew up in orphanages, in a foster home. She mm-hmm. was allegedly abused in a foster home.
Yes, her mother, I mean, again, her story is a story that we understand much better now. Her mother was a working class woman who was married as a teenager and had two children very young. Found her husband with another woman when she came home. The husband ran off with the children and kidnapped them in a way that is very familiar now. She had very little money, but she hitchhiked across country trying to get her kids back, and she never could, and that really broke her spirit in a lot of ways. Then, and of course, Norman Mailer in his book manages to accuse her of not, the mother, of not caring about her kids because she didn't have custody. I mean, it's, you know, unfortunately, he doesn't seem to have learned from the lessons of the 70s and 80s. But She then was working in a film lab, and she fell in love with a handsome, dashing salesman whom she hoped would marry her. But when she told him she was pregnant, he just left. And indeed, Marilyn herself spent a lot of several efforts anyway trying to reach her father, and her father wouldn't ever have anything to do with her. So her mother, who was doing the best she could, boarded her with a family so that from birth, so that she could keep on working, and she really only saw her on weekends.
By working with George Barris, you got to see the text that they were working on of her autobiography, and that included a lot of interviews with her. What kind of sense did you get from reading that? Was there a side of her personality that you weren't aware of that came through reading that? I don't know how much of it was ghostwritten in the part that you'd seen, because, I mean, truly celebrity biographies tend to be so doctored up and embroidered by ghostwriters that you don't necessarily get an accurate sense of what the person's like.
Well, at first I was sort of mystified by George Barris's notes because they were a combination of two things. That is, Marilyn's words were a combination of two things. One was protestations that she was, I'm fine, everything's all right, life has never been better, lying about things that clearly you knew were wrong, you know, in terms of her health or her drugs or her ability to work or whatever it was. That was all on the one hand. Then on the other hand, she would start to talk about her childhood and go off into kind of deep, introspective, kind of depressed descriptions of what her of the pain of her childhood. And I couldn't figure this out for a while until I finally realized that, of course, the purpose was to get her job back. You know, she had been dismissed from her last movie. The rumors were that she was completely unemployable. She was terrified that she was never going to be able to work again. She was 36 years old in an era when even to be over 30 as an actress of that, you know, glamorous kind was difficult. Her marriage had broken up. She was fairly isolated. I mean, so these protestations of I'm all right, everything's fine, and the kind of clear lies, you know, were, I think, a real, just an effort to present a good face to the world and to get her work back, since that was her only kind of saving grace. And a lot of that part of the interview is repetitious of the kinds of quotes she had given out in the paper, you know, almost word for word, like she had a public version of her life. But the childhood reminiscences are full of pain and reality and a lot of detail.
My guest is Gloria Steinem, and we're talking about Marilyn Monroe, who is the subject of her new book, Marilyn, Norma Jean. I want to play another Marilyn Monroe record, and I think this really epitomizes the sexual Marilyn Monroe, the Marilyn Monroe who always seemed on the verge of orgasm, you know, and really when you watch her, it's always how it seems like she's just quivering. But let's listen to this recording of Do It Again. Yeah.
mistake
to have you take the kiss
that's waiting for you.
You know if you do.
Mama may scold me,
'cause she told me
it is naughty, but then, oh, do it again, please.
Do it again.
Marilyn Monroe singing Do It Again. My guest is Gloria Steinem, who's just written a new book about Marilyn Monroe. Marilyn Monroe was just the ultimate sexual woman, always sexually aroused, singing like that. And I really like that recording, by the way. But from the way you write about her, it seems that her own sexual fulfillment didn't nearly measure up to her screen image of being constantly sexually interested and sexually ready.
Mm-hmm. No, on the contrary. I mean, by her own testimony and by the testimony of some of her lovers who really cared about her, she really didn't enjoy sex. I mean, she, or to put it another way, sex was a way that she could get nurturing and warmth and cuddling and comfort in a childlike way that she didn't get when she was little, but sexual pleasure in the sense of adult sexual pleasure was something that really eluded her. And her several of her lovers say that, too, that they thought she was probably never sexually satisfied, but she valued the kind of warmth and parenting and closeness, you know, that she could get from sex. And, you know, how many women, I mean, millions of women have had that experience of not, you know, not having orgasms. I mean, Marilyn said that she had never experienced an orgasm. Maybe she was exaggerating a little bit, but I mean, still, she didn't get that kind, this kind of sexual pleasure that she offered. And you know, the image she of being constantly sexually aroused that she presented is, of course, impossible. It's what is expected of women, but it's impossible.
I find that kind of poignant in a way. I mean, I wouldn't expect women to live up to Marilyn Monroe's screen image, but to think of Marilyn Monroe having so much problems, you know, so much trouble living up to her own image. She was probably competing with herself all the time.
Well, I don't know if it was competing with herself. I mean, I guess I would say it a slightly different way, that she was so desperate for approval and so much alive only when other people looked at her and saw her as alive. That she could never feel her own feelings.
You know what surprised me, too? The amount of plastic surgery that she'd gotten. You want to just go into that for a second?
Yes. She had the tip of her nose narrowed. She had her teeth fixed in various ways. She had her jaw line adjusted somewhat. Her own hair was kind of light brown. And she resisted having it bleached initially because she kept saying it's not me, but when she was modeling it was bleached, and she gradually kind of metamorphosed into the person we see.
What interests me about that is that some women still do, or many women used to work so hard to look like TV stars or movie stars or whatever, and even the TV and movie stars frequently don't really look that way either. And
it's impossible. I mean, nobody, if a punitive system really works, it manages to make everybody feel inadequate, which is what the ideal of beauty does, even for women who are beautiful.
She had the image of being the dumb blonde, and everybody's always debating about whether she was really quite smart and just hiding it, or perhaps she wasn't any smarter than she appeared on screen. What have you learned about that?
Well, I think it was a mix. I think she was enormously perceptive and sensitive in the way that people who are dependent on the approval of others and the judgment of others are very smart about the character of those other people. She was very smart about that. And she was creatively smart also, because she, when encouraged and allowed to do it at all, would tried hard to influence her professional career. Bus Stop, for instance, was a film that she developed herself, and she changed the costume, changed the makeup, worked on the script. She tried hard to learn the craft of acting. She wanted desperately to be educated. She would just go into bookstores and just leaf through books until she found something that interested her. And what interested her was often amazing. I mean, it would be Kafka or Rilke or Dostoevsky or something. She would carry around these books. People would make fun of her for that. I think that she lacked information, but she was smart.
Are you interested in all the conspiracy theories about her death and the nature of her affair with the Kennedys? How involved are you with that?
Well, sure. I mean, that's part of her story. I didn't want to focus on it because I was a bit put off by the number of recent books that focus only on her death and pay no attention to her life and who she really was. I mean, however it was she died, the point is, who was she and who might she be, might she have been, and what happened to her? But nonetheless, I was interested in that, and I read everything and, you know, talked to people and so on. And there are some real anomalies around her death, but it seems to me that they it's kind of 90% likely that they are the result of a cover-up with no crime. That is, there was a cover-up of her probable affair with Bobby Kennedy, certainly her friendship and probably her an affair, so that after her death, people cleaned up the house where she was living and, you know, got rid of any evidence and so on. But that had nothing to do, as far as I can see, at all. I mean, there's no evidence of murder or complicity in her death in any sense. It's just that we force people to be hypocritical about their love affairs, especially if they're politicians, and especially if it was, you know, the early 60s. And so people came in and, you know, Peter Lawford and others seem to have come in and cleaned up that house. If anybody had a motive to facilitate her death in some way, it would have been Jimmy Hoffa and the Teamsters, because Jimmy Hoffa was fairly clearly bugging her house in order to get tapes to embarrass Robert Kennedy. So theoretically, he might have actually tried to encourage her death in order to blame that on Robert Kennedy. But in fact, that never happened. You know, so, you know, even though the motive was there, the follow-through wasn't there. It just seems enormously unlikely that it was anything except one more suicide attempt or one more night on which maybe she didn't want to die forever, but she didn't want to be conscious that night.
Well, assuming she committed suicide, do you think that had feminism come around earlier and had she been able to interpret the events of her life in a feminist context, that she might have had optimism about her life and not taken it? I know this is the kind of thing you've been thinking about.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I realize this is my rescue fantasy, you know. I don't want to, you know, be unrealistic about it. But I can't help but feel that she would have been helped, because, after all, the central experiences of her life, being sexually attacked as a little girl, which was disbelieved by many people and probably disbelieved by Freudian analysts, you know, who Freud himself didn't, you know, insisted that it was just a desire to seduce that made little girls hallucinate these things, which now, of course, we know to be true. Her fear of aging, which now, you know, women are trying to break the age boundary, the very way that she grew up. There's so many parts of her life that that we now understand, because women have told the truth about it, that I can't help but feel that she would have felt less alone, and perhaps that would have helped.
One of the problems she had was, I guess, a problem that only very beautiful women have, which is that men are kind of afraid of you because you're potentially dangerous to them, and women feel threatened by you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Though she had a lot of women in her life who helped her and were close to her and were her friends, but only after they got to know her. I mean, women in general reacted negatively often.
You've talked about how people graft on their fantasies onto Marilyn Monroe and use her as a way to have a sexual fantasy or a rescue fantasy or whatever. And I wonder if you think it's possible to overdo it with feminist analysis, too, if it's possible to project things onto her that haven't existed.
No, it does. And that's why I said I realized that you know, this is perhaps a rescue fantasy, and I don't want to overdo it, because there's no way. It would have been up to her to know and up to her to decide. It's not up to us to decide. We can only hope that or guess that so many other women having had the same experience would have made her feel less alone. I mean, that's at a minimum, that's true. Now, it's possible, perhaps even probable, that her lack of love and attention as a baby and a little child was went so deep and produced such insecurity that maybe nobody could have helped her. She certainly was quite capable of victimizing other people in the way that victims do. You know, it was like pouring yourself down a well, down a bottomless pit, you know, to try to help her. But just the plea of her last interview, for instance, which was to end the interview with, don't make me a joke. Please don't make me a joke. You know, say, please end with what I really believe, that there should be peace and brotherhood in the world, that, you know, what we need to overcome. You know, all of these things. Of course, the interview didn't end with that. That plea to be taken seriously is something that women understand now and fight for and insist upon.
My guest is Gloria Steinem, and her new book is about Marilyn Monroe. It's titled Marilyn, Norma Jean, and it's published by Henry Holt. I'm just curious about this. You've been for years one of the most visible feminists, and you've always been pointed to by a lot of the media as being an attractive feminist because, you know, feminists were supposed to be...
Mm-hmm. If you could get a man, what else? Why would you want equal pay?
Yeah. Right. I mean, if you're attractive, what would you be worrying about a job for, right?
Right.
But did that ever... stand in your way at all, being attractive and being pointed to as an attractive woman? Did that ever create jealousies or boundaries, you know, between you and other women that you wished hadn't existed?
I mean, it makes you feel bad to be told that what you accomplish is due not to what you, not to your work, but to how you look. In fact, I think that being quote, attractive, unquote, whatever. Incidentally, I was never told that how attractive I was before I was a feminist. I think part of it, I mean, or rarely, you know, part of it is just the difference between their expectation of what we're supposed to look like and the reality. But to the extent that I was, I suppose it's a short-term advantage and a long-term disadvantage. That is, it's sort of used to make people remember you as a freelance writer. Oh, that's pretty girl who's a writer. You know, it's like that dog who speaks or something. You know, but in the long term, it was a disadvantage because it meant you weren't taken seriously. But I think what feminism made me understand is that if you're young or conventionally attractive, whatever that means, then and you do well, it's because of the way you look. If you're not young and not conventionally attractive and you do well, it's because of the way you look, you know, because you're compensating for the way. So what we all share is this problem of being evaluated for what's on our outsides instead of our insides.
You know, you're also, you've become so famous, really, in America, that I wonder if celebrities tend to live in a celebrity world. Do you ever worry about the celebrity nature of your status taking you away from political activism? Does it become more difficult to be involved on the level that you want to be when you have such a high profile?
Well, let's see. I'm trying to... I want to answer you.
I mean, you can't really be one
honestly.
Of the gang, you know?
Except that, I'll tell you, I think that the difference is, well, it gives me a different function. I mean, because what I can contribute to something is maybe bringing people out of curiosity or getting some other famous person on the phone. It causes me to play a specific kind of role sometimes. But it's celebrity with a content. I mean, it's not celebrity for playing many different roles or for selling dog food or sort of. The great gift to me is, and what makes up for all the bad part, is that I happen to be accidentally, it seems to me, just because I was working in the media in the first place, a recognizable part of something I care about more than anything. You know, so it's because it has that content, it means it's like sending out a signal and it becomes instant friendship. And that part is wonderful. And because I travel so much, I don't know if I can explain this. I've never tried to explain this. I mean, I spend 2 or 3 days a week wandering around the country giving lectures or doing benefits or organizing one way or another. So I spend all kinds of time in remote places and in airports and bus stations and just you know, everywhere. And people take care of you. Do you know what I mean? I'll be in an airport late at night and the woman who scrubs the floor will say, well, you don't have any place to sleep. Why don't you go in here? This is where we sleep when we have a couple of hours off, you know. Or the flight attendant will put me in first class or sneak me a steak or something. Or somebody will cash my check or recommend a book to me or come up and tell me what's happened to them. Or it's just, it's very moving. And I have to figure out a way to write these stories down to give them back. And it makes me think, I mean, I'm not saying this by way of comparison, but because I lived in India for a while, it makes me think of Gandhi always said that if you care about the people will care about you. And he used to travel all over India with no money. And, you know, he had no money, no possessions, no nothing. And people looked after him.
Do you feel you have to do something to return the favor when it's done?
Yeah, I do. I mean, that's why I want to write about it.
Mm-hmm.
But so the gift is kind of some sort of instant connection because you know that you care about the same things.
You know what I've been really wanting to ask you about? It really does seem that the biggest split in the women's movement over the past few years is over the issue of pornography. And with the Mies Commission, you had feminists coming down on every possible side and arguing with each other about what the true feminist stance was. And feminists were saying that other people couldn't possibly be feminists because they were taking the wrong stand. So you have some women siding with the Mies Commission saying that, yes, indeed, pornography can lead to actual violence against women and in that sense is dangerous and there should be regulations against it because of that. You have other women saying that any kind of censorship is bad and that the Mies Commission is basically anti-sex and that it would be dangerous to side with them at all. Where do you stand on that?
Well, I find this dispute enormously painful because I think it's unnecessary. You know, I sort of go crazy trying to say, but wait a minute, you know, if you really agree, if you just, you know, look at it this way. And probably that when I die and go to hell, that's what I'll be doing. I'll be saying, but well, I'll be in the middle of a battle. I'll be saying, but no, you really agree if you, and I'll just go on for eternity like this. But I don't personally know any feminists who sided with the Mies Commission on the remedies question. The only thing that I, at least, and any other feminist I knew shared with the Mies Commission was the understanding and belief and knowledge of studies that I think show that pornography does desensitize people to violence and does instruct in violent methods and does make it seem okay and, you know, does in fact encourage violence against women. But I don't know of any feminists who agreed with censorship. I think what most feminists are trying to do is to give each other the courage to speak out against it and say, look, you know, a Jewish person doesn't have to put up with friends who read anti-Semitic literature and Nazi literature, and I, as a woman, am not going to put up with pornography. I'm going to throw it out of my house. I'm going to speak out against it. I'm not going to, you know, buy things from the store that sells. And so that's very different from – that's using First Amendment rights. That's not censorship.
Well, yeah, I think a lot of feminists supported the Mies Commission in saying that there's – that pornography can be harmful. And they – although they disagreed with the kind of legislation – well, it wasn't really legislation that the Mies Commission recommended, but the kind of restrictions. A lot of feminists support other restrictions, like the Dworkin-McKinnon bill, which is very complicated
but that's
to explain.
But it's not a restriction.
But it would have the same function, a lot of women say. You know,
It may have been imperfectly drawn, but it is not prior restraint. I mean, something, the Minneapolis ordinance, as many people know, is not prior restraint.
Well, let me ask you this then.
It's not censorship. Yeah. I mean, it's just saying that if it's out there already and it's been published and it's there and you can demonstrate to the satisfaction of a jury that it's damaged your civil rights in a particular way, then you have a right to monetary damages. Now, that's not the same as it already has to have been published for that to be true.
But to cover yourself, you wouldn't want to stock it, perhaps, or, you know, people would be constantly endangered. But I guess, do you feel like it's possible to distinguish between pornography and erotica?
Mm-hmm.
How?
Well, I think it's like the difference between sex and rape. I mean, you know, it has to do with power. It's present, the difference, maybe this is a writerly notion, but the difference is present in the words to some extent. And I think we can get a grip on a distinction that way, because porne does mean female slavery in its Greek derivative, and pornography means writing about female slavery. Erotica comes from eros, which means love, which has some idea of mutual pleasure, mutual choice, mutual power. And those are two very different things. Now, granted, there's kind of, you know, never land sometimes because you don't know the motivation. But I think in most cases you sort of do. I mean, you know why men are always clothed and women are unclothed, just to indicate a power difference. You know why, you know, the whips and chains are there, or you know.
But this thing about whips and chains gets kind of complicated, because in lesbian and gay sexually explicit materials, there's sadomasochism. I don't mean exclusively in that, mm-hmm. but I mean there's lesbian S&M now, there's gay male S&M, and it's not a one sex on the other type thing. It's not a man oppressing a woman. So
But in the first place, we're not talking about censoring any of it anyway. You know, we're not talking about prior restraint or, you know, infringing on anybody's First Amendment anyway. So what we're talking about here is the sensibility.
But we're talking about the difference between
pornography and erotica.
So if you're using a power thing and saying that that's, you know, that's clearly what men do to women, and then you see that kind of power relationship in same-sex relationships.
Well, I would say, in same-sex relationships, there's more likelihood to be equal power and an exchange of roles back and forth. I think that's true. And therefore, it may, you know, come down to motivation. But just personally, it seems to me there's a difference between honoring wherever we individually are sexually and saying, look, we grew up in this culture. We learn to come to sex and love in roles. And we honor that in each other, and wherever we are and whatever we're struggling with and whatever is there, as long as it's free choice, we support each other in that. There's a difference between that and saying that is a goal. Because to state as a goal the confusion of sex with pleasure with pain is a very serious confusion, because the body protects itself by sending out pain signals, and that's very different from pleasure. It may happen to us that in our childhood we have been punished enough or treated in a way that has caused us to intertwine these two things, and we can't get them unintertwined. And so that's where we are, and that's an honorable place to be. But it doesn't mean that the goal is to confuse these signals of our body.
The feminist community remains split on how to handle the issue of sexually explicit materials. What do you see your role as being in this debate? Because there's a lot of open wounds right now, I think, on all sides.
Well, what is my role? It seems to me that there is a place where we can honor each other.
You're trying to play peacemaker?
Yeah, because it does seem to
stay almost in the middle.
It's not in the middle so much as it is to keep a grip on what we want to be true in the future while honoring where we are in the present. Does that make sense?
Can you be more specific?
Well, I mean to understand that it is physically dangerous to us to confuse pleasure and pain. I mean, seriously dangerous. At the same time that we understand that the way we have been brought up in our childhoods and everything may have led us to a place where we can't experience pleasure without pain, because that's where those signals are grooved in our brains, and that's the way we were brought up, and there's nothing we can do about it. Andrea Dworkin often says that sexual fantasy is memory. It's not where we are now, but it's where we used to be. And in any case, sexual fantasy, if you're sexual fantasy means that you're in control of it by definition. So having a rape fantasy is very different from wanting to be raped. Very different. You're in control of that fantasy, you know. I mean, it's two completely different things. And, it just seems to me that there is that place, but perhaps the clearest set of problems are the people who are the confusion between being against pornography and against the First Amendment. It seems to me to be against pornography is to use the First Amendment.
What you just said about a fantasy being different than a reality, people who oppose censorship in any form would say that any kind of fiction, any kind of like a pornographic film or book is operating on the
oppose censorship
fantasy,
in any form, too.
Mm-hmm.
But, and I think, you know, and so does Andrea Dworkin and Kitty McKinnon, that is not prior restraint. I'm not defending the murkiness of the way that ordinance was drawn. It's not easy to do that. But the principle of it was not to keep anything from being printed or published. It all was going to be printed or published. But if once it was out there in the public, you know, it had damaged your civil rights in a particular way, you had a right to try to convince a jury that that was the case and to get damages as a result.
We just have a couple of seconds left, and I want to change the subject completely for a minute. You turned 50 a year or two ago.
2 years.
I forget.
Yeah.
And there were articles in People magazine and all over about it and so on, big parties and everything. But, I mean, women, we were talking before about stereotypes that women have faced. One of the big ones is that when a woman gets older, she's worth less on every level, sexually, professionally, just every imaginable level. And then we all have grown up with these images of women like looking for the gray hairs and looking for the wrinkles and panicking about what it's going to mean to look older. How are you facing getting older? You know, are there things you're determined that you've made pledges to not do or to not worry about?
Well, you can't, of course, make a pledge. I mean, even though you know, I was at a foundation meeting lately, and a woman who's in her 70s and wonderfully full of energy and activism and wrinkles, and I mean a fabulous woman, and I was sort of complaining about the unexpected parts of aging. You know, I'd sort of got myself to a place where it was fine with me if I got a certain kind of wrinkle, but then this whole other kind of wrinkle developed, or, you know, my memory gets better or something. And she turned to me very kindly, and she said, "Well, you know, I'm glad you live in an era in which you can read what you've written." And I thought that was a really kind way of telling me that I hadn't quite internalized what I
Oh, that's great.
So you do keep learning over and over again. It's true. But I'm very glad that I live in a time in which we have this kind of support, and so I try to give the support back by being publicly 50, or in this case 52, and trying to press the boundaries back a little bit. But there's no magic answer. You keep learning similar lessons over and over again in a kind of spiral. You know, it's going in a direction, but it feels like sometimes you're going in a circle.
Well, I regret we're out of time. It's been great to have you here. Thank you very much coming back to Fresh Air. My guest has been Gloria Steinem, and the occasion for her visit is the publication of her new book, Marilyn, Norma Jean, which is putting Marilyn Monroe in a feminist context. The book is published by Henry Holt, and it also includes never-before-published photographs. We'll be joining National Public Radio for All Things Considered in 2 minutes. First, let's check in with shadow traffic.
Good afternoon. If you're traveling outbound on Kelly Drive, you're going to find some slowing from the Twin Bridges through the Falls Bridge, and southbound Route 1 City Avenue is slowing from Belmont through Bala Avenue. Southbound 95, slow conditions approaching Stewart through 476. If you're northbound, just a minor delay at the Ben Franklin Bridge. Also, a 5 to 10 minute delay eastbound on the Schuylkill Expressway approaching Girard through Spring Garden, and westbound is running slowly from 30th through Vine. That's shadow traffic. I'm Priscilla Fox on 91 FM WHYY.
That shadow traffic report was funded by Quality Plus Ford dealers. On Monday, beginning at 8:30 in the morning, we're going to carry live House Committee on Foreign Affairs hearings. Testifying will be Secretary of State George Shultz and Robert McFarlane. That's on the secret web of funneling profits from U.S. Iran arms sales to Swiss bank accounts earmarked for the Contra rebels. So we'll be carrying these hearings Monday, beginning at 8:30 in the morning. Tomorrow afternoon on Fresh Air at 4 o'clock, Village Voice columnist Cynthia Heimel will be my guest. She's the author of Sex Tips for Girls and But Enough About You, two tongue-in-cheek advice books. So I hope you can be listening. That about does it for this afternoon's Fresh Air. Stay tuned for All Things Considered. This is WHYY-FM in Philadelphia.
Fresh Air was funded in part today by a grant from Eichler & Moffley Realtors, with offices in Chestnut Hill, Bluebell, and Doylestown. Eichler & Moffley Realtors, bringing buyers and sellers together for more than 25 years. And English Greenhouse Products Corporation, designers and manufacturers of greenhouses, glass structures, and solariums for architecture, industry, and the home. English Greenhouse is proud to support Fresh Air and the free exchange of ideas.
Good evening from National Public Radio in Washington. This is Noah Adams.
And I'm Alex Chadwick with All Things Considered.
There's not any person, really, that we can identify medically that's safe right now. None of these people use cocaine intravenously. And all of them were using what they thought were sort of standard doses, standard recreational doses for them.
A new study indicates a link between cocaine and heart attacks, with the conclusion there does not exist a safe amount of cocaine. The story tonight on All Things Considered.
Also, Larry Speaks planning to leave his job as White House press spokesman.
We'll check around the country to see how the Iran arms sales story is playing.
Black college enrollments going down.
On a Cape Cod beach and not doing very well, a group of pilot whales.
Gloria Steinem on Marilyn Monroe.
And a Russian play opens a new arts auditorium in Los Angeles.
First, we have this news.
I'm Frank Stachow. Senate leaders announced today they've agreed on a special 11-member select committee to probe the Iran arms-contra-aids scandal. Senate Democratic leader Robert Byrd said he and Republican leader Robert Dole agreed on a committee of 6 Democrats and 5 Republicans. Their names will be announced December 15th, and the panel will begin work on January 6th when Congress opens its 100th session.